Dallas. That was some snow. That was
Yeah. We got more than our fair share.
Oh my God.
But you know what? What a difference a week makes. It's 80 degrees today.
80?
Yep. 80 degrees today.
80?
Go figure. Mm-hmm. Last week we were shut down. People, I had power, wasn't completely out for 3 days, but mainly out for 3 days. I had a couple hours here and there. You know, snow everywhere. You couldn't get around. Big, you saw the big pile up on the freeway, 133 cars, all this stuff. And by Sunday, I think it was like 75 on Sunday.
And today it's 80.
Yeah, yeah.
And today, well, it's 80 here too. Well, this is California.
Yeah.
It's 80 degrees there.
Yep.
And boy, he mm-hmm. sent me something from Flower Mound. He said, what a difference a week makes. Flower Mound, mm-hmm. all white.
That's right up the street, yeah.
White out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then, this week, complete brownout.
Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is that, trying to figure out exactly what happened. You know, a lot of people were mad at everyone at first about the power companies and things like that. And so I said, well, wait a minute. This is like once in a 30-year storm, or maybe once in 100 years. We don't know. So I've never seen it like this. So maybe they just were not prepared for something of this magnitude. But then
I heard they said they were not prepared.
Yeah,
they
but then that. We had the storm 10 years ago, which was nowhere near this. And they told them they needed to winterize the equipment. But these folks here in Texas, in their infinite wisdom, decided we don't need the federal government telling us what to do. We're not going to winterize. So they've got this company called ERCOT. Well, not a company, it's an organization. ERCOT Energy Conservation something of Texas or something like that. And they just said no. And even Rick Perry said the residents of Texas need to just basically just shut up and take it just so we don't have to do what the federal government tells us to do. While he sits in his mansion, you know, I'm sure he's got backup generators and all sorts of things. Shoot.
Oh, just like Rick, not Rick Perry, but what's that fool's, the maggot's best friend? What's his name?
Rudy Giuliani?
No, we don't have to say his name. He's so stupid. There isn't that much room in a brain to be so stupid. There should be a contest. Who's got the most room in the brain to be so stupid? The maggot or his buddy? Ted Cruz.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Caught going down to Cancun.
I don't think there's that much room in the brain to be that stupid. I just don't think there is. He went and bought himself some stupidity.
Apparently there is. And they get stupider by the
moment. And then he runs back to Houston and wants to help the coloreds with some water.
Yeah, the photo op.
Ted? Yeah. Really, Ted? You think this is going to change folks' opinion about your ignorant butt?
You know,
really, Ted? No, the damage has already been done.
But you know, there are still going to be people that will vote for him. That's what's amazing.
Well,
there was 74 million that voted for the orange Cheeto.
Yeah, he came back and he showed us that it was a mistake. And
then he threw his daughters under the bus.
Yeah, threw his daughters under the bus.
It was their fault. My
daughter said, "Can we go, Daddy?" And I just want to be a good dad. And when my daughter said, can we go, instead of saying that he wanted to teach his daughter something, mm-hmm. they should have had their asses down there helping those people in Houston.
Nope.
That's what they should have been doing. Daddy should have said, this is what we're going to do. Give you guys some real life lessons.
It may be the end of his career as a senator, hopefully.
Yay.
Maybe. But again, he won't have a problem getting a whole lot of votes, but it may be enough to take somebody else over the top.
You know what? Well, the two of them right now, the orange maggot, he's in deep trouble. And you see his son continues to come out and talk about how great he is and what he's done, and you people are gonna regret it. And you, well, guess what, buddy? You will be going to jail right along with him. So you need to shut up.
Oh, and of course Giuliani was on the golf course with Michelle Wie. Michelle Wie is a female golfer. She's probably 25 about now. Big female, 6 foot tall, hits the ball 300 yards, great golfer. Doesn't know how to win a lot, but you know, she's out there. And I can't remember who the third person was. It was another man. And apparently Giuliani was saying, you know, acting like he was a announcer. And he's saying, this is Michelle on the tee box and she's getting hit, yada yada. And she's got an unusual stance when she putts. She bends over and we can see her panties. Yeah.
No, he did not say that.
Yes, he did. Dennis is nodding his head. Did you see that, Dennis? Let me unmute you.
I did. And I'm an avid golfer, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yep.
Very tall, very lanky.
Yep. 6 feet tall. Yep.
And very few golf courts actually fit her. So.
Yeah, exactly. And she bends over at the waist because she's so tall. Mm-hmm. She bends over at the waist to, it's an unusual stance to, putt. But
and he said that wasn't on television.
No, it wasn't on television. But, you know, of course, Michelle, we heard him say it. You know, she's upset.
It as well have been.
Yeah. So people are upset. And speaking of golf, of course, you heard Tiger was in the accident today, this morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, right down here in Palos Verde.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So hopefully that may be the end of his career. Multiple leg injuries.
Multiple leg injuries.
Yeah. But he will still go down as the greatest. I'm sorry, he's better than Jack.
Oh, yeah, he will. Yeah, he absolutely will. There's nobody better.
Yeah.
I don't care how many Masters they win, there's nobody better.
No, he holds every record of significance except the number of majors, and that's Jack. He's got three less than Jack. But if you take everything else into account, especially the level of competition, I used to be an avid golfer too, Dennis, but I hurt my back about 3 years ago and I haven't been able to play. But you look at the level of competition and the way he changed the game. Every player on the tour now knows they owe their success to Tiger Woods.
Absolutely.
The game completely
changed. And their bank account.
Yes.
And their bank account.
Yes. The game changed completely after he came on. And you know, when he's not there, people don't watch. People do not watch. You know, you get the ratings just go way down. He's there, it's way up. Because any given time, he's in the hunt.
Right. Well, you know what? It just goes to show you, when Tiger Woods plays golf, everybody watches. When Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, and all of those tall guys play basketball, everybody watches. I don't know who the morons are on the football field, but when all of those guys play, somebody watches. But you know what? I'm still really mad at them. And Dennis McCasey, I hope you chime in on this. I'm still mad at them. Herschel Walker.
Oh.
I hope he walks up these stairs so I can sock him in his forehead. Really? Really? And I blame football for his nonsense, for the rhetoric that he's talking. I blame football. He obviously has a concussion. He has a concussion. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's probably got some mental issues going on. He's acting like he's really lost his mind, and he probably has.
He does have mental issues. You know, he tried to take himself out years ago when he played here in Dallas.
Yeah, and I blame football. That's what football does to guys. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it does. And they continue to play because the owners have said they're going to take care of them. No, they're not. They're not going to take care of them.
They're a commodity.
They're not going to do that.
They're a commodity.
And they talk about what Tom Brady, he's 43 years old, and he's still playing football. What a great guy he is, the GOAT, greatest of all time.
Mm.
Stop trying to live up to Tom Brady. You'll never get there.
Absolutely.
Stop it. Because they're not going to recognize you like that. They're not going to recognize you like that.
Nor will they let you. They will
nor will
let
they
you
let you.
And don't, you know I'm a huge Tiger Woods fan as well. And just understand everything that they could possibly have done over his career to prevent him from reaching the records that he did. Mm-hmm. They did. They threw it his way. When we talk about, we understand injuries, but when we talk about scandal and things like that, I mean, you're talking about the good old boys club down there when it comes to golf. And there's so much that's happening in behind the scenes when it comes to golf. But clearly Tiger was the one who moved the needle. While at the same time, what it did was it, sat his black butt down for a little while.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because they were getting tired of him winning so much.
Mm-hmm.
And so
absolutely.
The thing about golf is when you're not playing consistently, it definitely takes its toll on you. And so that's what ends up happening. You know, he's out for so many years. He comes back and, he had to climb his way back up to the top again.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's back towards the top. And then now this unfortunate injury, definitely may, it's going to make a couple of people happy. Because it will allow for them to be able to make the point or argue that Jack is still better because Jack has more masters. Right. I mean, more majors.
Green jackets.
And about what's his name? I don't know why his name escapes me. Right, he's hitting the ball 400 yards now. Not John Rahm.
Arnold Palmer.
No, no, Arnold Palmer.
Showing my age. I don't mind.
Hit the ball.
McElroy.
No, big guy. I can't think of his name. It's just for whatever.
Bryson DeChambeau.
DeChambeau. You know, he's hitting the ball a ton. But you know what? Nobody's talking about DeChambeau proofing the courses. They were talking about Tiger proofing the courses all those years. Remember that? Because he was killing his course. He was tearing those courses up. DeChambeau was tearing them up. Now he doesn't, he's not, cause you still got to put the ball in the hole in fewer strokes. The guy's hitting the ball. He's hit the ball 400 plus yards, you know. But a gorilla can do that, but you still, you got a chip and a putt, and he's nowhere near as good as Tiger, but they're not talking about doing anything. And frankly, without getting too deep into this, because I could talk about golf forever, these guys are tearing the courses up now. The scores are way too low. I'm sorry. Majors should be won at or around par. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 over par. You got guys winning the Masters at 13. And when Tiger did it, he was what, 19 under? Everybody else was like around par. Yeah, I get that. But when you've got several guys at 13, 14, 15 under par, the courses are way too easy. In a major, that's way too easy. It takes the fun out of watching a game. Again, I could talk about this forever. But again, folks, we've got Dennis McCasey, education expert, on this evening. And we are going to talk about education.
Absolutely. But before we get to education, I've just got to put my 3 cents in here. I like to watch golf. It is boring.
No.
But I like to watch golf. I'm not a sports fan, but I think golf is one of those intellectual sports like chess. So you have to watch it. But the last time I had a club, it was many years ago, and I was in a tournament. Couldn't see the ball. Didn't know where it went. And the only thing that I could do is volunteer to drive the truck, the cart. I drove the cart. I can't see the, once I hit it, where does it go? I got to find it. That just does not make sense to me. Yeah. I got to go find the ball and then hit it again.
That's why you got to hit it straight down the middle. Then it's easy to find.
Oh, and then it goes into the water and then it went over next to the cows. I wasn't going to go look for it. So I volunteered to drive the cart. I'm just saying. I do like golf. The others, because it creates morons. And speaking of what it creates, Dennis McCasey, we are so glad to have you on. These are some very troubling times. Yes. And education is suffering. Education is suffering. Our kids are suffering. And we have got to come up with solutions so that they don't suffer. And the interesting thing, anytime there is a pandemic, epidemic, trauma, tsunami, any kind of major issue, it's always the adults. Yes. It's always the adults, and the kids suffer because of what the adults do or don't do. How do we mitigate that? How do we stop that from happening? Because the things that we do, we're supposed to set examples for them.
Yes.
But I cannot say that we're setting the best examples for our kids.
Yeah. You know, thank you again for having me. You know, when we speak about education, it's something I'm extremely passionate about, similar to golf. You know, you got to understand that, you know, that things just don't happen accidentally. You know, there are things that are designed. The club is designed to do a certain thing. Right. Education is designed to do a certain thing, especially in our communities and things like that. We're talking about a broken system that was broken from the onset. It wasn't designed for Black and Brown children to succeed at the rate that they were. And so I think what has happened over the years, you know, I've been in education for almost 30 years. And one of the things I know for certain is that young people needed something a little different. And so the gift and the curse with the pandemic is, you know, the system that was broken, we were forced now to find another way. And so when we look at the integration of technology at the pace and at the level it's in, I'm actually more hopeful than the average person when it comes to our children's future now, because now we don't have to depend solely on outdated books that provide facts that aren't true about Black people anymore, about Black Americans anymore, about African Americans anymore. Our children can actually utilize these computers and actually look up the history of Black America and see how rich of a resource we truly have been over the years. So, you know, I look at this education now as a turning point for us to recognize that our young people are actually probably a little better off now than they were before this pandemic. There's always going to be some kind of there's always going to be some kind of divide, the technological divide. There's always going to be those things. However, what it did do, obviously, as I said, it has at least given us an opportunity to address the issues that education wasn't addressing before. The curriculums wasn't addressing before. The textbooks weren't addressing before. You know, so when I think about the insurrection that took place last month, it doesn't matter whether or not they ever put it in a textbook or not. It is forever etched on the internet. It is forever etched in the minds of people on YouTube and all social media. So that therein lies a way now they can't hide the truth from our young people anymore. And that's all we needed to give them in the first place, was give them a chance and give them the truth. And so I am one that looks at the situation with the pandemic as one that truly may be game changing and life changing for our people and our young people in the inner cities throughout this country.
Well, you know, you mentioned the fact that it's forced us to do things. When people tell me things like that, first thing that always comes to mind is the old saying that necessity is the mother of invention, you know.
Yes.
And so when we were forced to be in situations like this, you know, the smart people find a way. You know, they find a way to get it done. You have to stay home. You have to do this. You know, the people, there are going to be the people that sit around and bitch and moan and complain and this and that and the other thing. But the smart people actually find a way to get it done. And, you know, what's interesting also is that a lot of people were really big on homeschooling. You know, so basically it's just another step in homeschooling. It's just more and more people are doing homeschooling. And I get the fact that it's not as always easy for everybody. You have single parents, you've got maybe even two parents working. There's a lot of variables in there that don't make it as easy as it sounds. But there are ways. And in our community, you know, if you've got a few people at home, you know, we ought to be able to send our kids over somebody's house and learn, you know, or somehow do it within the community if the schools are closed. That's what I think people should.
Well, Kenny, what's important for us to understand when it comes to this technology is that, remember, technology isn't new to education. You know, you can go back as far as the 1960s when, you know, education and technology met for the first time and then, you know, begin to start to find its way in schools. And all the way up to 1997, 1998, blended learning is the title the label that it was given. We're talking about 1998. It is 2020, 2021 when the pandemic hit and we were ill-prepared with technology. That is not an excuse. We cannot make an excuse that the pandemic has caused any more of an educational divide than it, you know, than what happened before the pandemic. Our young people were not exposed to technology at the way and at the rate that they should in most schools. And as a former principal, I understand. I was a principal back in 2005 to maybe 2011, 2012. I had smart boards in my classroom. I had laptops throughout my building. I had iPads in my school. We're talking about almost 10 years ago, this stuff that children need now, we were using it for almost 20 years already. Well, what ends up happening is oftentimes we as educators may not necessarily follow the trend. Their technology has been amongst us as long as we all can remember. So why was that not a bigger part of education? Why was that not a bigger part of instruction? Because in many instances, I think the system really was hoping that we didn't realize that it was a need for technology.
Yes, I was going to say that. They did not know that they had a need for technology. Mm-hmm. And I was just saying to someone earlier that the people who want to protest and all of the people that say open the schools so kids can go back just as kids said, yeah, we want all kids to go back to school. We all want to be normal again. But one, if it isn't safe, if we aren't ready, if they have not controlled this, if you have people who are still contracting this disease, people who are still losing their lives, people who just can't get it right, is it the right thing to do? And we had a program on here last year, and we talked about whether or not this was going to impede education. It should not. It really should not. People should have found a way, and I said it very early on, people should have found a way to do exactly as you just said. The community needs to find a way to mesh, to collaborate, and come together and have school in one location that's controlled without going through all of these things that have gone awry. Yesterday on the news, there were three kids at a protest, and they interviewed each kid. Jewish kids, you need to open the schools because I'm losing my mind. I can't think. I don't have any way to do that. That's wrong. That is absolutely wrong. And parents who put their kids up to that, they're wrong also.
Absolutely.
They're wrong. Okay? They're wrong. And I know those parents put those kids up to that. Three little boys, three little white boys. But you cannot say for certain that sending all these kids back to school right now is the absolute right thing to do. You cannot say it. And I'm so irritated with these people because how in the world do you have educators, people who have been in education for 30, 40, 50, 60 years, you cannot find a way to find respect for teachers, for educators, but now you're running to put folks back into the classroom? Yes. You know what? You can't have it both ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
You cannot have it both ways.
Well, you know, the more I think about, you know, this discussion about what's best for, you know, for students and for staff, you know, I heard somebody say to me the other day, well, you know, statistics has shown that schools are safer than homes, and that, you know, and that when kids go back into schools, we should see a decrease in cases of positive cases. Well, I say to people, well, let's be logical for a minute. Let's not even be deep with it. Let's just be logical. If children are at home, families are at home, wherever people congregate is where the infection rate is going to be the highest. So if most children aren't in school across the country, and right now, you got some schools. I'll talk about New York as an example. New York, in some schools, you may have 20, 30 kids in the entire building at one time. And they do weekly tests in New York for COVID. And almost every week, 1 to 5 students out of the 30 test positive for COVID.
Wait a minute. 20 to 30 kids in the entire school?
An entire school, because most of the parents have decided to keep the kids home.
Right.
But then there's parents who decided
to send the kids in, and they're still coming
down. Them in.
Yeah.
So they send the kids in. So when the numbers are that small, you got 20, 30, 40 kids in a school, and anywhere between 1 and 5 of them are testing positive. Can you imagine if you put 200 kids back in a school?
Exactly.
Can you imagine what you can put 100 kids back in a school? So the mindset that people must have and understand is that there is no easy answer to this.
Right.
But what we got to think about, the best way to look at it is, if we're talking about the safety of the children and we're talking about the safety of the staff and the safety of principals who have to be in a building, you got to ask and weigh that. What are we trying to accomplish by sending or rushing people back in the building?
Right.
What are we trying to do?
Yeah.
You know, when Joe Biden mentioned, when he got into office and he said he wanted to get, you know, he was proposing, you know, all of this money to go into schools so that they can safely open within 100 days. I don't care how much money you throw at that problem.
It's not the money.
Unless everybody's vaccinated, you can't guarantee that it's going to work.
That's right.
And
it's not about the money. It's not about the money.
It's not about the money.
Right. And remember, are you back east, Dennis?
Yes, I am. I'm in New York.
You're in New York. Okay. New York is the number one largest school district in the nation.
Yes,
LA is the second largest school district in the nation, even though it isn't anymore. it's right in line with Houston, Dallas, and Chicago. Mm-hmm. LA used to be. LA has lost so many students. Well, how is it that the second largest school district in the nation has maybe 2 to 3 plant managers or custodians, janitorial staff members to clean an entire school? They're going to miss something.
2 or 3?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Well, you know, you said people.
And that was one of the things that the money was supposed to go to. So, so some of this money that Joe Biden has proposed is supposed to go with being able to safeguard the schools by adding, you know, more of, you know, more cleaning and more staff, you know, custodial staff and stuff like that. I mean, ideally, I don't care how many custodial staff you put in a building. You're never going to be able to completely safeguard against it. And so, again, whether or not you want to have the argument or the discussion as to, you know, how to minimize it, then say that. Don't talk about it in terms of, you know, it being eradicated now. You can't say that. The reality of it is, as long as people congregate in a place, whether it's in a restaurant,
right,
whether it's in a church, or whether it's in a school, there's going to be a spike in cases.
And you
so
mentioned,
why would you move kids into that situation?
And you mentioned that people are saying that they're safer at school. Well, where do they go after school?
Exactly. Home. If you're going to tell me they're insulated,
keep them at school. Just have them live at school. If you're using that logic.
At school. Yeah. Exactly. They're not thinking about that.
Yeah.
They are not thinking about
that.
No, they just want to get them out of here.
It's flawed.
Take them to school.
It's flawed logic. It doesn't make any sense at all.
It's flawed.
It's flawed.
And this is this is the ideal scenario that speaks to schools being glorified babysitters.
Yes.
This speaks clearly to that. Don't get it twisted. This is validating glorified babysitters.
Well, let me ask.
And the fact that they, for some reason, and I just don't understand it, but teachers are on par with doctors. Teachers should get the same kind of respect that doctors get.
But they don't.
And people who want to disrespect the educational community, who have nothing good to say about the educational community, I'll bet you trying to get your kid to the school today, aren't you?
But see,
want Miss Dorsey to talk to your kid, to handle your kid, don't you?
But here's what, and I'm not in education, so I'm coming from a complete layperson on this, but it appears to me that, you know, the public education has gone downhill for the past 40 years, and I think that's a given. But what has gone up has been minority enrollment in the schools. So I think it's no coincidence that minority enrollment and the quality is going down, you know. So when there's white flight, as they call it, you know, then the quality goes down because they don't care. So what are your thoughts on that, Dennis?
Well, I think leadership is everything, right? You know, as a former principal in New York City, Harlem in particular, what I did by way of leadership was I scanned the community and see what the needs are within that community. I recognized that poverty was a big issue. I knew our children did not have healthy meals. I knew that our children were missing school because of some issues that arose by way of, medical issues that arose where families didn't have insurance and things like that. And so in New York City, I worked with Jeffrey Canada, who runs the Harlem Children's Zone. And, you know, we had all these wraparound services in the school. So when we talk about healthy foods, we actually had a chef that was in the school that the only thing he cooked was healthy food for the kids. The kids could not bring in unhealthy food. They couldn't bring in chips. They couldn't bring in sodas. They couldn't bring in any of those things. And that was a school in Central Harlem where 98% of my kids were Black and Hispanic. So from there, we knew that the families, they couldn't go to any local supermarkets because they didn't have any, you know, high end supermarkets in the community. So the families had to go to the bodega to go and shop for meat and to shop for produce. So what did we do? We reached out to some local farms in upstate New York. And what we did was we decided that we were going to do every month, we were going to do a farmer's market where those people would basically bring tons and tons of produce to the school in Harlem. Our families would come, and for pennies on the dollar, would be able to walk out with bags and bags and bags of healthy produce to take home. In addition to that, in my school, we actually had a dentist office. We recognized that our children were, you know, there were two reasons why kids weren't coming to school by way of the notes that were being sent, is because they had either dentist appointments or they had doctor's appointments. So we put a dentist office in our building so that families who could not afford one to send it to take their children to the dentist, we had one upstairs. And then if a parent would say, listen, you know, he can't come to school today because he has to go to the dentist. Well, yes, he can. He can come to school. He can go upstairs to the dentist, and then he can come to class afterwards. And then lastly, we had a medical center in our building, not a nurse's office, a medical center, where our young people, again, if you're sick, come to school, because you're going to get the best possible care as you can, and it's not going to cost your families nothing.
And I applaud you for that. I applaud you for that. That's called doing what you have to do and not waiting on permission.
And that's where I think that when I speak enthusiastically about education, I put everything back on the quality of the leader that's running that building. What is the principal's desires? What are the principal's, you know, goals? What are the principal's aspirations for the kids in his school or her school? If you desire to do these things, you'll be able to actually convince people that it's the right thing to do. You know, we're talking about, there are some very generous people in this world that have, some very philanthropic ways of supporting schools and communities. And they are from all nationalities. They're from all ethnic groups that are looking to help support. If you actually knew the number of people that have reached out to us in Harlem when I was a principal to help and to actually support what we did, it was groundbreaking. We were one of the first schools in all of New York City and even across the country, because most people didn't know when Obama was in office, he implemented an initiative called the Promise Neighborhood Initiative. And my school was named Promise Academy. He named it after us because what Obama felt was, if we can provide these wraparound services for families and for children and for the community, then we can actually not only improve education, but we can improve the quality of the community. Yeah. Because we understood that if you want to change a community, you got to change the schools. And very seldomly have you ever been in a neighborhood where you have great schools in a poor neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly.
Very seldomly.
Wraparound services, I'm not familiar with. I think I know what you're talking about, but can you, for those who don't know what that term means.
Wraparound service is, again, you know, free health care for families, free dentist care for the families. Again, the whether it's job placement opportunities, right, whether it's, you know, workshops to help them to find jobs and things like that. The issues that are in the community, once we recognize what they are, we provide the services to deal with that. So when we think of when you think about really eradicating poverty, you got to know what actually exists by way of poverty in those communities. And poverty definitely looks different from place to place. You know, I've been in rural South Carolina working with principals, you know, down south, and that's a different kind of poor. That's a different kind of poverty. But one of the things you got to realize is that great leaders will go out and scan the community and see what the needs are and make sure to address it, again, with these wraparound services. And so just think about, you know, taking a child and wrapping your arms around them. So everything that's needed, all the care that's needed, we provide it by giving those wraparound services. Now, no one is just going to come and hand that out to you. In many instances, you got to actually know what you need and actually go out and find people that are willing to support that. And that's what great leaders will do. So from an entrepreneurial standpoint, as an educator, you got to say to yourself, I got to be willing to beg, borrow, or steal at times to make sure that my children get all the support that they possibly need. And to this day, the work that we've done in Harlem for over the past 30 years is continuing because of the generosity of philanthropists and other generous donors that thought that what we put in place was something that was worthy of funding, and also they needed it replicated across the country.
Are you still working with Jeffrey Canada?
I haven't worked with Jeff for a few years. When I left principalship with Jeff, I started my own company where I'm now a lead consultant for school leaders across the country. And I'm also the CEO of a non-for-profit organization called OSG, Off School Grounds, where I basically almost all that Jeff has taught me, everything Jeff has taught me, I'm utilizing to actually continue to walk in the path that he blazed for all of us. You know, and it's funny that you ask that because, you know, when I think about the work I've done with Jeff, there is probably no more passionate individual when it comes to education and community development and youth development than Jeff Canada. And to be able to say that I've sat and stood alongside that man for as long as I've had, I'm telling you, no one can tell me that there is a stronger willed individual in this world than Jeffrey Canada.
Yeah. And it's in fact, the fact that he is not the Secretary of Education and he should be, how do you put a Betsy DeVos in there and you don't even consider Jeffrey Canada? Jeffrey Canada has the ability to turn around every school in the entire country. Mm-hmm. He set a precedence on so many things in education when it comes to how kids conduct themselves, how they go to school, their thought, their practices, their discipline. Everything that he did was right. Yes. Everything that he did was right. He was the brick builder and the brick layer. And it's unfortunate that he was not made Secretary of the Department of Education, because he certainly should be.
Well, the one thing I will say, though, is anybody who's worked with Jeff for as long as I have, he's instilled so much in us that we're going to change the world, whether he's the Secretary of Education or not.
Or not.
Anybody who stood next to Jeff was empowered with knowledge, understanding, wisdom, compassion for communities like Harlem, Brooklyn, you know, Houston, Chicago, Compton. If you've been around Jeff, it's no way that you cannot go and change the world. I mean, that's why I say for me, you know, right now, over the past year during the pandemic, I started this a not-for-profit coalition of educational experts, as well as, you know, political officials and athletes, as well as entertainers that are joining forces to actually change education the way it looks, the way it feels, the way it sounds. And what I know, where my passion came from, my knowledge and my understanding of it came from working alongside Jeff. So as I change the world, the only person I can look to aside from God and say that he impacted my life, that's going to be Jeff. Because what Jeff started, he didn't expect for it to end because he retired or because he moves on. Like, he expected us to carry that work on and stuff like that. So whether or not he ever became Secretary of Education or not, his work speaks for itself. And anybody who's ever worked alongside Jeff will and continues to change this world. And I'm definitely one of them.
Has he retired?
Yes, he's retired. He's retired from the day to day.
Okay.
But understand, Jeff, if you know Jeff, there's no such thing as retirement for him. You know, the work that he's done and continues to do, he's still always going to be that face, that face of change.
Right.
That Harlem is experiencing right now.
What is the future?
I read about, what was that?
What is the future of education? Again, we're going through this pandemic right now. We're going through a period in time, some trying times with what happened on January 6th, the pandemic. You know, the world was turned upside down. You know, we've been in this pandemic, you know, over a year now. So what do you see as the future of education, public education, and how do we make sure that in our community, our people understand that, for example, I'm not a big proponent of Black History Month because that portends that you're not talking about Black history the other 11 months out of the year. So what's the future and how can we make sure that our community understands we've got to do 90% of it ourselves?
Well, I'm extremely optimistic about it. I really am optimistic about education. And I realize that, again, as a person who works alongside, you know, hundreds of principals across this country that are making a difference, that and teachers that are making a difference every day. Again, it's just another hurdle, another obstacle that we have to overcome. And, you know, and especially those of us of African descent, you know, we understand what it means to, you know, to prevail. We know what it is to strive. We know what it is to not allow a challenge or an obstacle to prevent us from achieving our goals. So I, as a person who recognizes my power from my ancestors, I understand the rich tradition of Africans and, you know, and our ancestors, the one thing that you can't stop me at this point. You can't stop me from wanting to change a community. And so my optimism comes from the fact that as a leader, I know that I'm in full control over the success and failure of the schools. One thing is going to happen. One of the two is going to happen. Either you're going to fail or you're going to succeed. And in both instances, as a school leader, I feel myself and principals all across this country hold that as, you know, the options in our hand as well. And so when I and other principals that are doing great work, like a good friend of mine, Akbar Cook from Westside High in Newark, New Jersey, or Principal Eamon Raw from Compton, when I think about people that are making a difference in their schools right now, our schools are in much better condition than people think. It's just a different way of doing things. When we talk about, you know, just even talk radio, right? You know, it's changed. It didn't stop. If anything, it evolved. Education the same way. It's just, mm-hmm. you know, great mm-hmm. leaders evolve mm-hmm. the things that they believe in. So I'm extremely optimistic, and I'm extremely, you know, optimistic that technology, if embraced, will be the game changer for our young people. We gotta, I think the initial phase of people villainizing technology and education because it was new is over and beyond us at this point. We gotta embrace the change and recognize that it is the wave of the future. Our children are still smart. Our children are still amazing. Our children are still bright. You can see our Black and brown children across this country still excelling despite what people might say. They're not brain dead dummies walking around here like zombies. They are still flourishing and doing great things. I have children of my own, DJ who's 16, Kayla who's 8, my oldest is 29, but my 16-year-old has done better during remote learning than he did when he was going to school every day. Kayla, my daughter who's 8, is doing better. She's always been doing well in school, but she adjusted. She adjusted, and she doesn't mind not going into the building every day.
That's right.
So the reality of it is that I think we have to change the narrative, and I think we have to change what's being said about what's happening with our children.
Right.
And understand that, yes, it was a stumbling block. It was something, a hurdle. However, our kids are still brilliant. Our kids are still doing amazing things. If you want to see it, go on social media. Go on YouTube. Look at what our young people are doing. Look at the entrepreneurial spirits that have been birthed in our young people as a result of it. You got more young authors now than you've ever had before. You've had more young entrepreneurs than you've ever had before.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't tell me that it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
You can't when we see it.
And how do we teach kids the values if we have to succumb to, oh, they've got to get to school. They've got to get to school. And that's the parents. Yes. Because rushing them off, and it's irresponsible, is not teaching them how to be resilient. It's not teaching them how to resist the temptation of I got to get to school because of this, because of that. They need to know and understand resilience, perseverance. They need to understand integrity. They need to know how to appreciate the education that they're getting, whether it's in school or out of school. Parents don't want to spend the time teaching, one, because they don't know how to teach. It's what kids are learning nowadays is beyond them. And I'm in education also. When I went to the administrative office, I thought, this is the first time I've been in the administrative offices. I don't like working with adults.
Yes.
No, I do not. I do not. I don't. Because once you see what goes on at the adult level, especially at the leadership level, and I have said this to probably 1,000 people in one place, it ain't about the kids. Education is about money. It's all yes. about money. It's about the business of education. I'm down here at Beaudry. They don't care what goes on at a school. They do not care. In fact, the enrollment division that I was in last year, we never talked about kids. We never talked about the kids.
So let me confirm what you just said is true.
Yeah.
So you got to remember, when children fail, people get rich.
Lost his sound.
He lost your audio.
Okay.
Yeah. So when you think about education, and you say to people, when we walk around talking about how schools are failing, what that then does is signal to big business,
yep,
let's create more things to actually help those struggling children. So if we can't, the reason why we can never say the educational system in America is actually going well and that children are learning and that children are flourishing is because it's going to put big businesses out.
And that's like the prison system.
It is.
So, okay, so you cannot have a school that is doing well. The kids are doing well. I can't stand the standardized tests. Mm-hmm. But if every kid passed those tests, if they scored high, all of the plethora of tests, you'd put everybody out of a job. They can't have everybody doing well. We had schools here that were the 10 worst. They got big money every year. They got lots of money for being the worst schools.
But when you take a very close look at that,
yeah,
it's not black organizations that's getting that money to help come in and change the dynamics of the school. It's not. And so that's why I think people got to be careful and with their pessimism when it comes to education. Our children aren't as bad off as people might think. Education isn't as in bad a shape as people might think it is. It's designed for us to say it.
Yes, it is.
The more we say it, it's the more people believe it.
Yes.
So when we say that there's educational, there's learning loss because kids don't go to school, what that then does is tell the big businesses, you guys need to create something that's going to make a lot of money because if we say that the kids are farther behind, then what we can do is we can create these programs and these software programs and these books. And then from there, now as a school, I'm going to force the schools to go out and buy these books. And so just because you're my friend, Ken, and I know you own that book company, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make sure that you get the contract for millions and not billions of dollars.
That's right.
So we got to know what it's really about. Like, we, you know,
that's right.
That's why my optimism comes with saying that great school leaders, great teachers, great communities will understand that when I walk through streets of Harlem, when I walk through Brooklyn or when I'm in Chicago and other places, what I see is excellence. What I see is beauty. What I see is a rich history. Does that mean there's not violence? Does that mean there's not drugs issues? Of course it is. But guess what? If you and I go to white America, it's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
You know, people kill where they live.
Yeah, exactly.
The same thing. Yes.
You know, listen, I'm a big fan of you know, shows on the ID channel. And one of the things that I always see every time I turn on TV is that there's white folks that are killing white folks.
Yeah.
And we never say that it's an epidemic
of white on white crime. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah.
But it gets to a point where when we as black folk continue to hear black on black crime, we actually are the ones
we believe
that. We start believing it.
Yeah, we believe it.
And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
Exactly. But when you think about education, it's no different. If we keep telling everybody that our school systems are failing our children and everything else, and you believe that, it gets to the point where school leaders and teachers believe it.
They absolutely. Yeah, they do.
You're the one leading the school. You're the one teaching
right.
the kids.
Yeah,
so
fix it.
Yeah.
Somebody else tell you, and then you didn't fix it?
Right.
No.
Right. That absolutely. Here at Crenshaw High School, which I talk about frequently, right now, Crenshaw is under construction, and they've been under construction for 2 years. And the first year that the architects and the city and the board and the superintendent, big meeting in the library, this meeting was the meeting of all meetings because they laid out these plans to change Crenshaw High School. They wanted to change the face of Crenshaw High School. They wanted to put in an auditorium. They wanted to put in a performing arts building and this and that and this and that. And they at the time, they were only spending something like somewhere between $70 million and $100 million to do all this work at Crenshaw High School. Well, just know, 8 years later, the ticket has grown bigger. But guess what? Guess what? When I said, you guys don't need to get happy because this is not for you.
It's not for you?
It's not for you. Stop it. This is not for you. It has nothing to do with you. There's a lady that I see who is the plant manager. She said, Ms. William, these Black folks don't know this. That's not for them. They're not getting that. They're not getting white folks are not going to spend that kind of money on Black folks. And they are not. Because right now, the majority Hispanics. And they're taking over in California. I work for migrant education. My focus is making sure that those kids whose parents work in fields of fishery, cannery, picking, packing, baking, all of that, I have to make sure that those kids stay in school. So we provide up to 10 different resources and services so that those kids can stay in school, whether they have a green card or not, whether they're legal or not. Because California is a sanctuary state, LA is a sanctuary city, the district is a sanctuary district. So my focus is to provide schools that will allow my staff members to go in and talk about the services that are offered only to Hispanic kids, only to Hispanic kids. So when I asked, are we providing services for all immigrants? Or just Hispanics? No, this is all immigrants, Mexicans. That's it. Really? Yes. Yes. And that's a no joke. Yes. That's, and you cannot get anybody else to creep in. Doesn't matter what boat they came off of. Does not matter. It doesn't matter at all. These services are strictly for Mexican kids. That's it. And they get them for 3 years. So just imagine. If a parent qualifies for the program and that parent has four or five kids, they get services for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. Okay? They get services for the rest of their lives. Okay? So we provide for them. And I'm saying we because I still work for them. And I see it every day. The writing is on the whiteboard and the chalkboard and the wall. Black kids, on the other hand, they don't get, because when Black people here in LA, when they speak, they think somebody's listening, but somebody always comes back and always says, you don't really mean it that way. I know you don't, but let me tell you what we're going to do. And they just say, okay. And that's why LA has become, and you mentioned Compton, that's why LA has become the pit. It has really become the pit of education. My daughter is up here at Windsor Hills Elementary School, and she thought about bringing her daughter to Windsor Hills. No, indeed. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I've got two daughters who are real adults now, probably your age. When they were young, my husband said, oh, no, they can't come here. They're not coming. He taught here at LAUSD, and I work for LAUSD. But my kids never went to an LA school. My granddaughter is in Altadena. My granddaughter will never go to an LA school. Not ever. And I've seen some things at some of the schools that are relatively attractive. Eyebrow raising. But based on what I know, no. 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 I don't want my granddaughter to be in a position where I have to worry about her and her education.
Yes.
No, I no, no. So she will never go to an LA school. Not at all. we have had issues where, well, here at Crenshaw, all of the kids who are graduating are given the opportunity to consider Black colleges, going to one of the historical Black colleges. But there and in other places, going to a Black college, that's a substandard education. That is an education that you might want to just not do that. We had someone on the show and he was talking about his nephew going to college. And he said that his choices were Yale and Harvard. And I said, oh, that's great. And we all think about Yale and Harvard being the, doesn't get any better than that, top tier, the Ivy League, Yale and Harvard. So I said, what about a Black college? Oh, no, never, never. Oh, he ain't going to go, no. I said, well, why not? He can get a great education from there. He wants to go to the best, and I want him to go to the best. So are you saying that they're not the best? No, they're not. How will they ever get to be the best if folks like you continue to say that they're not the best?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well,
but that's education. That's education as a whole. If we keep saying that the schools right. in New York City, Houston, Chicago, LA are all horrible, all I'm saying is if that is the case, then let's do something about it. Let's put amazing school leaders, principals, teachers right. in those communities so right. that change can take place. We're not saying that. And ultimately, people have their own choices to make as to where they want to send their kids. Obviously, do what's best for you and yours. But I am saying is that across this country, there are school leaders, Black principals, females, males. We got a lot of people across this country that are doing things to change communities and the schools. And they're just not getting enough recognition. They're not getting the one where people are telling the world the greatness of who they are. And so I made it a personal, you know, something personal now, that every chance I get to tell the world on how amazing some of our principals are across this country, I'm going to do it. Every opportunity that I get to say there's a principal that's changing the world over there, or changing the world in his city, or changing that community, or changing this, I'm going to talk about it. Because we got to start to ingrain in people that everything isn't dismal, that everything isn't a complete loss, and that our children don't always have to be, you know, shopped out of or, you know, moved out of a bust out of the communities to get a quality education. All you have to do as school leaders and all you have to do as community leaders is to make sure you put the best principal and the best teachers in those schools. And you can change it. You can literally change it. Nothing is supposed to be easy. I mean, it's not supposed to be easy because it hasn't been for us ever. And I just feel that if we can begin to shed the light on the greatness, which is Black leadership, and let people see how amazing people are, there will be a strong likelihood that we can begin to build back the trust that we do know what we're doing when we're talking about running schools.
And I think you're absolutely correct, because the more people begin to buy into the, let's call it propaganda, you know, and everything's bad, and it's like people being broke. Colette, there was the girl that you talked about, who won the lottery and kept bailing her boyfriend out of jail. Why was he selling drugs?
Boyfriend out of jail.
So it becomes a state of mind. So no matter how much money, if you got a broke state of mind, no matter how much money you've got, you're going to act broke. Same thing on the other end of the spectrum.
You're going to be broke.
It's same thing on the other end of the spectrum. Wealthy people right. act wealthy, and they'll always be wealthy because that's who they are. So I get what you're saying, because it becomes who people are. All the negativity. Everybody talks about the negativity. Oh, it's not this. It's not that. And then, of course, the kids hear it and they think it's bad. And the other thing, and I wanted to mention, I want to know your feelings on this, is that, you know, Colette mentioned the fact that, you know, people are talking about get the kids back to school. School is not the only place to learn. And I think that's a big problem, is that all of a sudden we got the kids thinking, Well, if I'm not at school, I'm not supposed to be learning anything. I go to school to do that. So if I'm not at school, I'm at home. I'm going to go ahead and play. Learn. I'm going to play my video games. You know, I'm going to go play with my friends. Right. I'm not supposed to be learning.
It's a recess.
So how do we instill in people that school is not the only place to learn? School should actually augment what you've been taught from home.
I feel that about
Black history. But go ahead.
Yeah, but I think it's, again, it goes back to we gotta start changing the language and changing the narrative. If we keep telling young people that the only way that they can learn is by being in school,
right?
If the learning loss is just continuing to compound and to increase because kids aren't in school, people will start to believe it.
Yeah.
It's a herd mentality. If I can tell you that something is broken long enough, I can convince most people that something is broken, even if it's not.
Yep.
And so what ends up happening is we allow for people by way of media, social media, and anything else to tell us how bad things are without us actually doing any research on us on our own. The one thing you can't tell me as a person who spends a lot of time in different schools all across this country, the one thing you can't tell me is that people aren't busting their tails every single day to provide the highest quality of instruction for kids. You can't convince me that principals aren't going and sacrificing their lives every day, walking into buildings, even with 30 kids or 40 kids. They're busting their behinds every day to make sure that those 30 or 40 kids are getting a quality education while in school, while the other 200 children are getting a quality education remotely. At the end of the day, we got to start telling people, before you open your mouth and say how bad things are, I'm always a person to say, show me, prove to me. Most people who say that aren't in schools. I'm in these schools. If you are not in schools, what qualifies you to tell me how bad things are?
That's right.
Because a magazine told you, but because you heard it on the news?
Absolutely.
Let's stop permeating this issue of our children just not our children failing, our communities failing and everything else, because what it does is it sends people into this hysteria and oh my God. So you know what? Since our kids are, you know, because parents care about how much their kids learn and everything. So what ends up happening is if we end up telling those kids, if we end up telling those families, well, you know what? Your child is going to be two grade levels behind if he don't go to school. Those parents who care about their children, they're going to say to themselves, you know what? Let's just roll the dice, y'all. I can't afford for this my child not to go back to school, so I'm going to let him go back to school.
Right.
But that's ideally what it is. That's what people want you to believe.
Yeah,
they want you to believe things are so bad with our children that we need to send them back into these buildings and actually increase the possibility of them getting sick or dying.
Right. Absolutely.
It's not only children that are going into these schools. There are adults that are walking into these buildings who care about kids every day, and we're not talking enough about what sacrifices they're making every single day by coming into school because somebody want to rush children and everybody
rush them back.
Right. Absolutely.
And that becomes a political thing. It's become political. I mean, you know, just wearing a mask has become a political thing. You know, I'm in Dallas and I'm a gun guy and I go to the range a lot. Well, I did before last year.
That in common too.
Oh, cool. In New York, we'll buy the guns.
But
there's a range. I go to an outdoor range and they've got like a 200 yards and 100 yards where I do shoot my rifles. But I stopped going there recently and I didn't want to go back. A, because nobody there wants to wear a mask. And B, they've got signs all over there of the name of the last guy at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, whose name we don't mention on this program. And knowing that these people are in that mindset, you know, and so people begin to have these mindsets and it's politicizes everything. Everything has been politicized. So, and I watch a lot of the news and I just watch these policymakers, these lawmakers. We got to get these kids back in school. We've got to get the kids back in school. They're not going to learn anything. And every time I watch it, I go, there are other ways. But because like I said earlier, they are a lot, those same people probably were pushing homeschooling for some of their constituents, you know, but it becomes a political thing, you know, so we've got to be able to get past that.
It's always political. And some of those people who are saying get kids back in school, get kids back in school. Those are the very same people that have opted for charter schools,
yes,
that have said, I want my kid in a private school. I want my kid in something other than a public mm-hmm. school. So some of those people think they can have it any which way they want. And some of those people, and I'd venture to say quite a few of them, they're doing it for selfish reasons. They're doing it for selfish reasons because they think teachers don't matter anyway. Absolutely. Most teachers are just glorified babysitters. So you and it really, people ought to see what has happened in education that they really don't know anything about. And I feel exactly as you do, Dennis. Stop talking about it. You're never there.
You're not there.
You're never there. So stop talking about it. You don't know anything about school. Your kid goes to school, comes home. You still are not there. So stop saying the things that you don't know anything about. That has always been a pet peeve of mine. Yeah. And my recommendation to everyone, you need to spend a day on a campus.
Yes.
If you're going to talk about it, you need to spend a day. Doesn't take very long. It does not take very long. Spend a day on a campus. Tell me what you think then.
Absolutely. You know, and it's so critical at this point for us to know how quickly you can change your narrative. Once you change your language, you change the narrative. You got to keep changing the language. Stop letting people tell you that Black history is something we need to celebrate in February. Because what ends up happening in many schools is that's the only time they actually teach it anyway.
Exactly. And they teach you about Harriet Tubman, George Washington exactly. Carver, and Barack Obama. And that's it.
But here's the thing that I push to people. Don't be mad. Don't be one of those people who say, well, you know, I'm mad that they're only allowing me to teach Black history in February. What do you mean allowing you to teach?
Exactly.
You mean allowing
you. Allowing you. Exactly.
Great teachers will find a way to infuse everything you need to know about education in those lessons.
Yep.
Period. Because if we left it up to them, we will only learn about 4 to 5 Black influencers mm-hmm. ever.
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. That's
always.
Right.
It's the same ones over and over.
It's the same one all the time. And it's not going to be anything any different.
I read an article a few years ago about a college professor. I forget what college he was at, but he was a history professor and he was talking about how appalled he was at how ignorant these kids were coming into colleges and universities and still believing things like George Washington cut down a cherry tree and told his father, I cannot tell a lie. You know, I mean, there was nothing. And he said, you know, if you go to any of the math classes, you know, algebra, calculus and all, there's a floor of what you have to know to get into those classes. He said they came into history not knowing a thing.
But I think you therein find the answer as to why the former guy in Washington and the people who follow him follow mm-hmm. him.
Yeah. Yes.
Because the same propaganda, the same narrative that has been passed down to them from generation to generation and generation about who we are, that's what makes them do what they did back in January.
Yep.
That's right.
Somebody made them believe
yep.
that they're above the law.
Yep.
Somebody made them believe yep. that what they did was okay. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about well how ill prepared people are for college, that includes them too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, yes, yeah, yeah, does. Absolutely.
Some of us might not be able to read or articulate things as well as some other people.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what? We also not walking around here telling you that Christopher Columbus discovered America.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're not telling you that no more. Mm-hmm. We're not the one walking around here wearing Indian headdresses and stuff like that and calling these teams the Washington Redskins or the Cleveland Indians.
We're
not the ones doing it.
Yeah. Right. Right. Absolutely.
So you got to recognize that the conversation has to shift towards changing the narrative by changing the language. Once you change the language to make people understand, stop telling me about my Black people and how, you know, because the moment Black people start working for people, they call them lazy. If they don't want to work for somebody, if they want to go out and start their own business and they want to be entrepreneurs, they're lazy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, I just didn't want to work for you no more. Why is that a problem, sir?
Yeah.
Why is that an issue?
Mm-hmm.
But again,
it's not an issue when they do it.
It's all in the language. And so we got to be careful that if they're telling us or giving us the indication that this is what they feel about us, we can't say that about our people. We can't walk around here telling me that my black and brown kids aren't beautiful and they aren't smart and they aren't intelligent. You can't convince me of that. You can't.
Words are important. Language is important. This whole defund the police thing that's been going around. You know, things like that, you've got to say what you mean because people expect that you mean what you say. You know, and if you say things wrong and they're coming back saying, well, we don't mean defund the police. We just mean move the resources. Well, then say that. Because what you also do is you give ammo to your adversaries. You know, so mm-hmm. the people on the other side say, and they're actually doing it. You want to defund the police. No. Well, you said it. Why didn't they? Then you get into another battle? So you're exactly.
But that's what ends up happening. And so because we hear it so much, defund the police, mm-hmm. we start saying it, not even understanding what that really means.
Yep.
Stop. If you don't know what it means and don't say it, all we're basically saying when you're saying defund the police, it's just basically begin to put money in places that we can build stronger relationships with law.
Right.
The officials as well as the community. That's all it really means. It's just moving things from here to here so that we can actually.
But you have to say that. You have to say that.
If we say defund the police, what it comes across is that we're saying that we devalue the police.
Yeah.
Defund and devalue. That's
defund,
what. But we're not saying that. But that's why I'm saying in education, we got to be very, very careful to not allow people to say how bad things are, because there are kids, many of the kids that we know in our communities, our own children, our nieces, nephews, our grandkids, they're not of that population of kids who are not doing well. Why are we allowing people to tell me that our kids are falling so far behind? I get it.
Language. Yeah.
When kids stop learning or stop doing something, just like, you know, Kenny, when you talked about not playing golf, when you put down a golf club for a few years, it's going to be very difficult for you to pick that thing back up and be at the level of efficiency that you was before. Education's no different. If kids aren't in school and that, you know, children are maybe losing 3 or 4 months of in-person instruction, that doesn't necessarily mean that they've become dummies.
No.
It just basically means, you know what? We just got to give them. We got to find a different way.
Find a different way. Find a different way of doing it.
Different way for them to learn.
There was back in the 90s when MTV was on, especially when it first allowed, using that word, black folks on MTV, they had a weekend program with teens on it. I can't remember the name of the program. But this particular one I was watching, and they had a bunch of black kids on it. And one young black girl I think she was like a freshman or a sophomore in college. And she said, I want to, you know, get my degree and, you know, get an education, you know, basically get a good job, become a contributing member of society. And another black girl stood up and said, why? They ain't going to let you do nothing. No way. And, you know, again,
why?
Because why? She has been taught. It's obvious she has been taught that no matter what, well, don't do it. Just don't do it because they're not gonna see her language. They're not gonna let you. And see, as long as we think they have to let us do something, like you said, allowing us, they're not gonna allow us to teach. As long as you've got that in your mind that somebody's got to allow it, and we always on this program talking about stop waiting on permission. You think somebody has got to allow you to do it? You've lost the game. You lost right there.
And when you guys speak about intentionality, the reality of it is that what's the intention of mm-hmm. people who said that the educational system is a mess and that our kids are failing? And what's the intention? Do you really believe that they're uncovering that for us so that we can get
so better? That we can fix it?
No,
they're not. They're basically telling you it's bad so that we can give you help.
Right, right.
We can send in the cavalry to come and fix your problem for you, because it is not people that look like me or you that are going into these schools that are fixing them, that are receiving millions, if not millions and millions and millions of dollars. It's not us.
Right.
So they can tell you and convince you that it's broken. That means they can send their folks in there to make sure.
Hang on a second. Colette, what happened to your sound?
Okay, I'm not real sure, but I'm trying to adjust it right now. Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, Dennis. She was getting some feedback there.
But yeah, go ahead. No, I was saying, you know that ultimately, that the going back to what I mentioned earlier, that in order for big business to continue to thrive, they can only thrive when things are bad, when things are in need of, or things of revitalization, or to basically be redone. And so when you think about education, it's no different. It's really no different. That the more we say something is broken, that means that they got to send in
the
Calvary.
They can come in,
send in the Calvary.
And all I'm saying, how many different, every new president that comes in with a new secretary of education, everybody has a new education reforms. That's supposed to be better than the one before.
Yeah.
Better than and nothing before. Has changed.
And nothing has changed. And I look at it similar to, like, again, you know, Kenny, you got me started with this golf thing for a minute. But when you think about golf clubs, there are companies that literally put out a new set of golf clubs every 6 months.
Yeah, yes.
That says they're better than the one that they just put out.
Callaway. Callaway was putting out clubs.
The question of it is, well, wait a minute. Why is that? Like, you just told me 6 months ago
that's yeah. It's just like the phone.
You changed your mind, and now it's all of it. So it's the same thing with the iPhone.
With the iPhone.
How many different ways you going to tell
exactly.
me?
Exactly. And it does the same thing.
It does the same thing. Yep. But again, if I can convince you that you need it, if I can convince you that it's broken, it's all about the language. Oh, you need this. I think, listen, it's the camera. The American camera.
And see,
if that's what you're going to do, then why not just go buy a camera?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Why go buy an iPhone for $1,200, $1,500 when you can actually go buy a quality camera for $1,000 to $2,000 that you can keep for a very long time that you don't have to keep upgrading every year?
Every year.
And the phones are only designed to last 12 to 18 months.
That's it.
Planned obsolescence. I call that planned obsolescence.
12 to 18 months. And we tell people that kind of propaganda, that kind of mind control is so important. And it really is not. I see that there's so much detriment in that if you allow somebody to tell you how good it is, and they laugh at me because I still have a flip phone. Mm-hmm. And I got that flip phone in 2000.
And see, people don't know what they want. People don't know what they want. People
it still
don't.
Work, don't it?
It still works.
Okay.
But see, people don't know what they want, and then they get told what they want. You take, for example, the Hummer. Nobody was beating down GM's door saying, we need this big, giant, behemoth machine that I can crawl up the side of a building so I can drop my kids off at soccer practice.
Right.
But after the Gulf War, they saw those up there, and somebody had an idea, said, let's scale it down a little bit. And tell the public, you need this thing, and we charge them $80,000. And people went out and bought those things. And let me ask you this. Have you ever seen a dirty Hummer? No. People don't get them dirty. No. Because they spend $80,000. They don't. I've seen one dirty one, and I've seen one actually towing something. You know, and these are big four-wheel drive, big giant.
They're of no use.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is none. But again, you know, once again, you know, there is something to be said about a herd mentality.
Mm-hmm.
It's something to be said about that. And as an educator who has put a lot into this profession and have seen the results and the fruit of my labor, I can tell you, nobody can convince me that it can't be done. I've worked alongside some of the most amazing people on the planet. And, you know, if you know anything, again, like I said, going back to Jeffrey Canada, you can't convince me that what I was part of didn't happen. You can't convince me that the success that still remains in Harlem, when we talk about the real Harlem Renaissance, that doesn't exist without what Jeffrey Canada did in Harlem. That don't exist. So when we say that, I'm telling you because I lived it. So when somebody tells me that these kids can't reach a level of mastery or a level of proficiency or a level of success, I'm saying it's you that are stopping that from happening. Not me, not anybody else. It's not the white man. It's not that person. It's you who've actually embraced the mindset that these kids can't learn. So you'll never get me to tell you that, oh, no, you know, this is a broken system and it can't be fixed. It was broken. It was broken from the onset.
Yeah,
but we found a way.
You said it right. It was not built for us.
To fix it.
Together and to fix it and everything. And then what happened by way of the pandemic is that this technology has given us even more power, even more opportunity to extend learning beyond the classroom for our young people. So
right.
Yeah. So I'm optimistic. And you know, I'm optimistic about what's going to happen in education. I'm proud of my Black and Brown children across this country, our Black and Brown educators, the people who genuinely care about kids. I'm proud of the work that they've done. And I can tell you that as somebody who's in the trenches every day with educators, I'm telling you, things are not nearly as bad as they would want you to believe. Doesn't mean we don't got work to do.
Oh yeah.
I'm just telling you, this system that they say is failing our kids, believe it or not, there are kids that are actually flourishing and kids that are thriving under right. these conditions. And we right. cannot discredit what's happening with them.
Right. And I think it's just simply, it's a pattern that was spawned after, I can't even imagine. I think it has a lot to do with PTSD. Mm-hmm. I think that it has a lot to do with wanting to keep a certain group at a certain level in a certain place. You know your place. I think there's so much that goes into that, that, as I said before, people who don't know the first thing about education should not talk about it, should not open their grisly mouths. They shouldn't say a word. Don't even utter school, because they don't really know. And as you say, it's not as bad as people say, or it's not as bad as they would have you believe. And I'm not sure about your school district, but the school district here has a huge union, UTLA. And I don't know if New York.
New York is one of the biggest teachers union in the country.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
So the union here is not allowing teachers to go back. So there's a big fight. And Buettner, who is the superintendent here, he's on television every day talking about what kids are doing and what they're not doing and the need for them to go back. Now, he's afraid because yesterday and the day before, now he's talking about reopening schools when the union is talking about not until we're ready, not until the conditions are different, not until we're out of the purple tier, not until the rate of positivity has diminished, not until people are going into schools and not coming out infected. So there are a lot of variables. There are a lot of things going on. But what's going to happen with Austin Buettner? First, he's not an educator. He is not an educator. And he is the absolute wrong person to be in the position that he is in. He never should have been superintendent of LAUSD. He's not an educator. And he said during his first speech, they interviewed him just before he went into the district. He said, I'm not an educator. I don't know anything about education, but I'm willing to learn. I couldn't believe he said that. I don't know anything about education, but I'm willing to learn. There were those that said, well, at least he's honest. Are you kidding? You can't be that stupid. Honest about not knowing anything about education, and he's going to run the district, and he's going to be paid $300,000 to learn about the district on the backs of all of these kids.
I'll take
that
job.
That's okay because he was honest. Wrong again.
CNN has an article online. Educators may be more central drivers of COVID in schools than students.
But you would assume that to be true, right? Because you got to think. Most teachers don't live in a community in which they actually work.
Mm-hmm.
So if they happen to go into a restaurant or a bar that may have a little bit more lenient restrictions on that over the weekend, they're hanging out, they're at the restaurant with their family, stuff like that. Now they come back into Compton, they come back into Watts, mm-hmm. they come back into these areas. What's happening? You can't control that. I mean, you can't control a person when they're off the clock, but you got to say, well, common sense says that everybody who's going home don't stay home. People go outside all the time.
Yeah.
And if you believe that a mask is the thing that's going to prevent it from happening, you fooled yourself there too, because the mask in itself doesn't prevent COVID. It just makes the other person that's in your presence feel comfortable.
Right.
That's right. What happens. So you cannot guarantee at this point that teachers or the adults that are coming back into the building won't be bringing in those symptoms that they caught over the weekend or when they were
right.
You know, right. Because their kids, some of their kids go to school, some of their families, you know, their husband or their wife may be going to work elsewhere. They may work in a hospital.
Yeah.
You don't have a clue.
And you don't know where they've been.
Exactly. And then what you want to do to me when I walk into your building is to hold up a temperature gun in my head and say,
and you think that's all, right?
That's all.
That's all.
Who are you making feel better about that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
must be you. Cause it sure ain't me.
It sure ain't me. You know, right. Just to take my temperature, that sound good. That sound good to somebody. But right. To me, it's like, but that's just a symptom. That's a symptom of
yeah, exactly.
Of exactly. Many symptoms of people that contract.
And some people are asymptomatic. Some people are completely asymptomatic.
It's asymptomatic, symptomatic, walking around with and don't even know it. So but that's what I'm saying. Until schools begin to actually take a real pragmatic approach to addressing this issue and stop trying to fool people by just saying, let's just sanitize the schools more, let's just clean the schools more, let's just do all these, let's change the schedule.
Everybody's looking for an easy answer.
You know, less children to be at school at the same time. Let's just stop fooling people and stop. Just call it what it is. Right now, we have not found the right answer. Right now, the bulk of the country is still unvaccinated. We understand that the bulk of the people may not ever get vaccinated, especially in our community, based on what we've gone through over our
fear. History. That's right.
You know, but you say, well, just send them on back to school. To me, it's just irresponsible on so many levels, because I think the same energy that we put into creating propaganda is the same kind of energy that we can put into actually resolving the issue.
What are your feelings about the vaccine? What are your feelings about the vaccine relative to school? Should teachers be mandated? Should they mandate students, faculty?
We live in a country where democracy should take precedent over everything. You can't tell me, unless it's law, you can't tell me that I have to do anything. And you shouldn't feel compelled to do it just because everybody else is doing it. Once again, you know, people talk about science, and science is the reason, you know, science has proven to them that the vaccine is effective and that, you know, is safe and things like that. But guess what? Along with that, science is history. There's history of what vaccines have done to people of color over the years, Black people in particular. You can't tell me that science is more important than history. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't tell me that. You basically got to have me to understand, why should I trust you now?
Yeah.
Why should I trust you now? Like, again, you just shot me. You shot me in my leg, right? You didn't kill me. You shot me in my leg.
Yeah.
You think I want to be around you again knowing that you have a gun in your hip? You think I want to be around you again?
No.
The answer is no. So I think people would like to believe that it's a very cut and dry scenario of, oh, yeah, let's just vaccinate everybody. Mm. But you can't say that. You just cannot say that, because we don't know everybody's reaction to it. We just don't.
Right.
And you can't convince me that we as Black Americans have been living with the AIDS virus for 30, 40 years in our community, and they ain't come up with a vaccine for that. But we sure enough were able to come up with a vaccine
for this.
A couple months.
Right.
You know, as an educator, my critical thinking skills won't allow me just to accept something just because somebody tells me to.
Yeah, just and on now, face value that you're supposed to do it.
They're definitely talking about teachers going back only if they've been vaccinated. Mm-hmm. So what I also found out was that in order to be on a campus, those people who want to go back to work on a campus or in one of the offices, they have to be vaccinated before they go back. I got an invitation to make an appointment to be vaccinated. That ain't gonna happen. So I'm not doing it. My daughter isn't doing it. I don't know anybody that is. I know some people that are going to be vaccinated, but that does not necessarily mean that they're going back to the campuses. And just as you said, you can't force people to do this. The biggest thing that I found to be wrong with that is that the essential workers are nurses, doctors, anybody in the healthcare industry. Those are essential workers. The other level of essential worker is a grocery store checker, somebody in retail. Those are essential workers. The next level of essential worker is somebody in a gas station, tire shop, whatever else, essential worker. The other essential worker is a gym. The other essential
gyms are not essential.
They're not essential.
Buy yourself a set of weights and work out at home.
That's an essential worker, okay?
Gyms are not essential. I don't care what they say.
They are not essential workers. But here, that's what they claim is an essential worker. But my point is, they never, not one time have they said that teachers, anyone in education, is an essential worker. Mm-hmm. They have not said that teachers are essential workers. They have not said. So what does that tell you? Teachers don't need to go back. I'm not an essential worker. I'm not going back. They have not given them that title, that name of essential worker. They have not done it. So, but you want to tell teachers it's now time to go back. Here in LA, they withheld information about the number of students and the number of adults that had been infected. And by the time the rumor mill got it, there were over 500, and now it's over something like 1,100 people that have been infected. Two people have left this earth. At the time, it was two people that have left this earth as a result of COVID, but I'm sure there are more. But LA began to feel the heat about not disclosing what was going on in the schools. So the schools say, well, we can't tell you about the kids. We didn't ask you to tell us about the kids. Nobody wants to know about the kids, but folks need to know about what's going on in the school. How many people have been impacted? How many people are positive? How many people are involved in this? And large numbers. So 1,000 people out of, and I don't remember the number of all the people in the district, but it's quite a few, but 1,000, come on, that's a significant number. That's a significant number. It's not like 1,000 is really more like 100. No. But if that is the case, remember, and I'm telling you, they still have not said that educators are essential workers. But you got a gigantic group of folks downtown protesting to send folks back to school. But you have not said that teachers are essential workers. I think that something needs to be said and done about that.
It's political. It's completely political.
It's political.
Because I know these people.
That's why I was saying.
Talking about gyms, people mad that they can't go work out, and do their Pilates and their Zumba and all these sorts of things, And we've had several doctors on the show, Dennis. We've had several times. We've had adults, and we have some doctors that do a show with us every first and third Tuesday of the month. And the doctors have said, mask and social distancing. If everyone wears a mask and uses social distancing protocol, that would do more than what the vaccine is going to do.
Of course.
I think
those things require people to actually do their own research, mm-hmm. right? Many people, the level of research and the level of knowledge that they get comes with, going on Facebook. Going on Instagram, going on YouTube. That's where people get most of their knowledge from. It's not strange that you're closing down more Barnes and Nobles. There's very few of them left. There's very few bookstores left on the planet, that when you look on even the book sales, ebook sales and stuff like that, they're at a low on Kindles and other things.
And you would think it would be at a high at a time like now with more people at home, nothing to do.
But you know what? But again, it's easier to just basically scroll through Facebook, right? Because that's where people find their news. That's where people find their news. And there's an intentionality in that. It's intentional for you. If the first thing most people do in the morning, they get up, they check their Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, they check those things. So they are ready or programmed for whatever that thing just told them. To the point where people, if you ever watch the irresponsibility of people at times, they will reshare and repost things that you didn't even fact check yourself. Just because it seemed right.
That's true.
It seemed right. And I'm just like, keep in mind right now is that whether you're talking about a vaccine, whether you're talking about education, whether you're talking about anything, it requires research. It requires you to take some time and spend time understanding the facts, right? How long did it have to take for us to realize that Christopher Columbus did not discover America?
And people still argue.
Why did it take us that long to do it? Because at one time or another, education was all that was given to us by way of the teacher. That whatever the teacher told us is what we learned. As we got older, and we even look, and that's why I have a lot more faith in our current group of young people, is because no longer are they just reduced to doing what a teacher said or what a teacher told me. They can do a lot of research themselves now and find, just if you want to, there's no shortage of real information out there.
And you know, the interesting thing is that how many older people are caught up in that, you know, I'm 66 years old.
Yeah.
And some people I know, they are people before Facebook came along, some of my musician friends and things like that. I mean, these guys are on there every single day.
All day.
It's like, what are you doing? Facebook. There's a guy, I don't even know who he is, but I'm sure he's a friend of a friend, or maybe he used to come see the band's play or something. He drives a truck and he delivers heavy equipment, right? This guy posts every stop. Okay. I fired the beast up this morning, had to stop and get gas. On the way there, stopped at Whataburger and dropped off the equipment and headed to the next spot. Oh, and he does this all day long. And I'm like, really? Mm-hmm. People need something, you know, to latch on to. And they've latched on to this. And you're right. They see things. And that's how we got into the last 4 years. If Twitter did not exist, the last 4 years would not have existed. I guarantee you that. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's how we got into there. And I'm going to tell you, and I've been saying this for years, social media is going to be the downfall of this civilization.
Yeah.
It is. And you know, it's just like with anything else, if you tailor it to fit what it is that you're trying to do, whether it's start a business and things like that, and if you're using it effectively, most people don't have the ability. People don't have the willingness. People don't have the mental fortitude to do it. It becomes entertaining. Everything is entertainment. So when I turn on the TV, most people watch movies and watch sitcoms and everything like that for the entertainment value. But within that, because there is always a message in everything that we watch, everything that we hear. But people get so caught up in the entertainment part that you didn't even see the truth that they were trying to tell you right in front of us. When you go back 20, 30, 20 something odd years ago, when Will Smith's movie, you know, Enemy of the State, where basically we were AI and security and everything, his phones were able to track him. The everything was being tracked by something that was on his body. My thing is, well, isn't that life imitating art?
And see, life imitates art, yes.
Imitating life. Yes. I'm saying life imitating art. So when it comes to letting you know what's in front of you, they're telling you every day.
Right. But
because, and unfortunately, you know, there are many people who are just not going to change, you know, that this is who they are. You know, they don't look at life that way. It's, you know, it's not that deep. It's just Facebook. It's just Twitter. It's just Instagram. It's nothing too deep. But reality,
it's very deep.
It is very deep. When you spend that much time on it,
that's right.
And you allow the message to continue to come
out. Mind control.
That's what it is.
There was an article I read today about reality television, and I hate reality television.
Oh,
and it's interesting. This article was positive about reality television, telling us how reality television is showing us what's happening in the real world. And I'm thinking, no, it's not. Reality television, it's scripted. And reality television is only telling you what they want you to see. You know, nobody was beating down ABC's door or whomever, the cable company. We want to see the Kardashians. You know, The Bachelor, all these things, and they're hugely successful programs. I mean, there's no doubt there. But that doesn't reflect real life. Things like The Bachelor don't exist, where you've got five women vying for one guy or five guys vying for one girl.
30. How about 30?
However many, and they go to these exotic islands. Yep, that's not real life. You know, the Kardashians are rich and famous for being rich and famous, which started with Paris Hilton.
Right.
But it's
But isn't that indicative, you know, of what we discussed about education?
Yes.
Yeah. Thing.
If they can convince you that if they can convince you that it's reality.
Yep.
Then you start.
Then it's reality.
Then it's reality. You know what I'm saying? So and that's where you got to be very, very careful. That is a person who may not, you know, Ken, I heard you say something earlier, and I wanted to correct you, because most people who say, well, I'm not an educator. You don't have to be an educator to be educated. You're an educated man, and you know what's happening in this country. You know that when you take a step back, when you look at young people, not the young people on social media that's out there doing stupid things that's going viral. I'm talking about that young girl graduated at 14 and on the way to college. I'm talking about the young entrepreneur at 10 years old that are writing books and becoming authors. We're talking about young kids that are actually starting their own protests and everything else that they're doing. That's the ones we don't see on social media, but that's our reality. That's the real reality, not what they show us on social media. So it's very important that even as somebody who may not feel that you're in education or that you may not be qualified to talk about it, listen, education is not a silo. Everything that I can find in music, in entertainment, in sports is the same thing I can find in education. It requires great leadership. It requires talent. It requires passion. And it requires a team that's willing to actually communicate and actually to carry out a vision collectively for the success of the team.
Right.
And that's all it is.
Yeah, that is.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I saw behind you a little while ago, Ken, you had some, you know, I think it was some guitars behind you.
Yeah,
right? Bass guitar behind you. The reality of it, listen, most people would tell you, you know, we don't play guitars, or we're not musicians, or, you know, we just got to tap dance and everything else. But then when you pull that out, I don't think anybody realizes that you can play as good as you can. Right. And at the end of it, you got to say to them, it's not about what you believe that I am. It's who I know I am. If we start convincing young people that they're great, that they come from a rich background, a rich ancestry, that they're amazing, that they're lovely, that they're smart, then guess what? That's going to be the self-fulfulling prophecy.
Right.
If we keep telling them how bad they are, how messed up the communities are, we keep talking about
that's what we get.
That's exactly what we get. There's no other way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, exactly. I could.
Exactly. And when you give kids these instruments, these phones, and you tell them they're much smarter than we are, you give them this phone and you tell them this is your lifeline, that's all they know.
Yes.
That's all they know. And I don't remember what Jeffrey Canada said about phones in the schools, but I fought tooth and nail not to allow phones in schools, because it was a major distraction to kids. And the very kids that they're talking about, that they're saying don't learn, why are you giving them this instrument, this device?
Yeah.
Why are you giving them something that's a major, major distraction?
We could have done. What we could have done, if as educators we recognize that it could have been a distraction, just make it a good distraction. Allow the young people to bring the technology into the school, and for us to show them how to utilize it for their own education and for their own edification, and how they can enhance their intelligence. Because guess what? Even though there may be a distraction in a sense that they go on, you know, on certain apps and things like that, right now, if you think about it, if we were able to make learning, learning more accessible for children on their phones, then you would have more children that will actually be logging onto classrooms every day. Because a kid may not be wanting to walk around with a laptop all day, but he has his or her phone every day. So what does that mean? If we can teach young people, listen, you know what? Let's do this. For 10 minutes today, guys, I want you all to take out your phones. And what we're going to do is we're going to do some research on our phones. I want us to actually research the Seminoles. I just want everybody just pull out your phone. Let's just research it. And then from there, what I want you to do is just jot down some notes on what we're going to do. In 10 minutes, I'm going to ask you to put your phones away, and then we're going to actually pick up the lesson. Something as simple as that. Yeah. So in other words, it's a controlled way for them to utilize it, right? Not don't do it at all, because they're going to sneak to do it anyway. I'm just saying, because I know young people, they're going to do the exact same thing you tell them not to do.
That's
right. I said, you know what? Let's say, you know what? 10 minutes, guys. Take out your phones.
And see, there's such the phones have such a stigma.
Yes.
That when they walk onto a campus, if you have a phone, I have taken away so many phones, I can't count them. Mm-hmm. I've taken away so many phones. And I want you to know, the kids that I took the phones from, they just about lost their mind.
I lost their mind. I know they did.
Just about lost their mind. You got to be, oh, I got to have, no, Ms. Williams, I got to have my phone. I got to, lost their minds. They could not be without their phones. But the very teachers who should be saying, exactly as you, let's do some work on here, they're not doing it. They're fighting against it. And they're not doing that.
But you know
why? And the reason they're not doing that is because they don't have the mindset to think that way.
Absolutely. So it keeps permeating from person to person all the way down to the young people. So we get administration that says no phones. Then we get teachers that say no phones. Then we got young people to believe that phones are actually the villain, as opposed to us saying, well, if that's going to allow the children to become more knowledgeable about how to use this thing, because most people don't even know how to use their phone. They just know how to use apps. That's it. They don't really know how to use a phone. I would probably say more than 50% of what's on this phone, most people never use. So my thing is, well, why, if you're in the classroom and you're trying to teach young people, let's just say, I don't even care if you're teaching math, there's a calculator on your phone. Pull out the phone. It's okay. 10 minutes. You build a level of trust with young people for them to recognize that you're not here to disrupt their lives. That if we utilize this to help, it can make a difference, but it's going to take for people to shed their initial thought about how this is the devil. You know what I'm saying? My thing is, if that's what you all believe, again, who told you that? Who told you that? Right now, if I ask a young person, do me a favor, I need some information about the nearest restaurant, the first thing that kid's going to do, pick up his phone and find that for me. What does that mean? That he recognizes the power of this technology. He understands the power that's in his hand. And what we've done as educators is that we took it from him. Now we're telling you, we don't want you to learn from this, because you might learn the truth here. Pick up that textbook that tell you that, again, that George Washington and about Christopher Columbus. And let's talk about cowboys and Indians. Let's just continue to use those textbooks versus, come on, guys, let's do some real research. Let's do some real research about, you know, Masa Musa. You know, let's do some real research about Egypt on our phone. Because guess what? They're not telling you the right stuff in the textbook.
Right.
No.
But if I tell a kid, let's just research pyramids of Egypt, and let's just use this, our phones, to give us some real concrete evidence. And what we do is we'll merge all the information together, and we'll come up with a true consensus as to what we actually learned collectively. That's what you should be doing with it, instead of saying, oh no, put your phone down.
But like
you
said,
put your laptops away, put that away, and pick up that lying behind book that's been
right.
Spreading lies and propaganda for the past 50 to 100 years. I don't want you to learn the truth.
Yeah.
Pick up that other book
with
a bunch of lies in it. That's what I want us to learn from today.
But you got to have, like you said, the teachers with the mindset, and the teachers not waiting on permission.
Yes.
You know, everybody thinks they have have permission. We've talked to people on this program about churches doing something, doing more education in the community and things like that. And we've had people say, oh no, I'm involved with the church, we can't do that, we're going to lose our 501(c) if we start talking about politics. You know, what do you think Joel Osteen, Jim Baker, all these guys that were supporting the last administration, whose name we will not mention on this program, you know, they're on television every day supporting that guy. They're not losing their 501(c), but we got people in our community. Somebody threatens them, oh, I'm going to lose this, I'm going to lose that. You know what? Maybe it's worth the risk.
Absolutely.
Maybe it's worth the risk that you get and you start teaching somebody some truth. But go ahead.
But that's why I say that with education, it's no different, right? It's really no different. People will convince you that the things that work don't work.
Yeah.
They'll convince you that what kids have been learning is the right thing for them to learn, although we know it's been the wrong thing for all these years. We understand that for, it was 2020 when the pandemic hit. Why are our kids still using textbooks when we go over, when we go across the ocean and kids were learning using technology?
Right.
They're doing all the things that made, that were making the world a global competitor in their country, because they were using this technology to build more technology to sell it to us.
Right.
You just mentioned something.
In LA,
I have to tell you.
They're still trying to get kids with the technology. There's still homes that don't have the internet. Homes still don't have computers. They're still trying to pass them out, especially in my department. Who needs a computer? Who needs a computer?
Everybody.
Well, it's almost, school's almost over.
But you just said something, Dennis, about them telling you and making you think this. I started publishing a for the network a monthly newsletter that we'll get you on the list. And I'm putting in it, but I'm calling Daily Words. And these are the daily words I'm putting for our March edition of the newsletter. And this is Malcolm X. And I quote, "When the people who are in power want to create an image to justify something that's bad, they use the press. And they'll use the press to create a humanitarian image for a devil, or a devil image for a humanitarian person. They'll take a person who's a victim of the crime and make it appear he's the criminal, and they'll take the criminal and make it appear that he's the victim of a crime." So exactly what you were saying.
Right.
He hit the nail on the head.
And you know, you can fight it all you want. You can tell. And that's why I say, you know, oftentimes you either get educators or, you know, or intellectuals that come on radio shows, come on TV shows, and sometimes they just so deep with it for unnecessarily. The bottom line is that when you think about it, it really isn't that complicated. It's been a mind shift. It's all it takes is for us to shift our minds a bit to understand. If they told you what it is, chances are it's because they wanted you to believe that.
Mm-hmm.
They want you to believe that thing. The things, no one is telling us how to have billions of dollars. No one's teaching us how to have 800 credit scores. No one's teaching us how to create generational wealth. We have to search for that information. But yet and still, we let everybody tell us about everything else. See, like I said, they tell you what they want you to know.
Want you to know.
And we've that got- thing that they want you to know on oftentimes does not have the full truth connected to it. So you end up believing that we're marginalized. You end up believing that we are permanent underclass. You believe them because they let you believe that that's what it really is. And so you kind of create this hysteria.
Yeah.
And we've got about 8 minutes left, and I want to get Leonard in here real fast. Leonard, trying to unmute you.
Oh, okay.
How you doing tonight? Yeah.
How you doing, brother?
How you doing, Ken? How you doing, brother?
Good. Good to see you.
Yeah, you in the East Coast? You in New York?
I'm in New York.
Oh, New York. Okay, good. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. As Kenny mentioned, many of our guests that we have on, we're all talking the same language, and we understand our opportunity. The issue is, and you know, I'm always advocating that, is that we don't really have cultural collectivity, because all the greatness that's within us, why don't you just utilize it and work under one umbrella? You know, yours is being in education. Mine is running restaurants. Kenny and Yolanda, their thing is talk radio show. We have all the tools, but we struggle with collectivity. But again, everything that you're talking about is right on point. And I'm glad you're optimistic about the future of our youth. But I do, me personally, I do feel we have some opportunities. Hey, Kenny, you know, did you guys listen to Frasier today? The thing I sent you guys?
No, I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet. No,
I didn't get a chance to.
Yeah, and that was in 2015, but he's all on point too as well. Dennis, you know who George Frazier is, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. If we could send that to him as well. But again, you know, it all starts with education. And I think one of the other talk shows that I was listening to, they talked about how our kids, 30% of our black males are not reading at grade level. And so what they were saying is, well, how are you going to go to school if you can't read? How are you going to hold on a job if you can't read? So, you know, education is something that's paramount with us right now. But again, you can have all the education that you want, but if we're not working together collectively, because we don't need to be talking about the white man no more, and now you hear the heat, you hear the heat on Biden administration. You know, is he going to work on reparations? And although we got him in office, he's already talking about taking care of the Hispanics. Okay. Already, he's already issued money to their community. I think it's 40, it's either 40 million or 40 billion. I can't remember, what it is.
40 million.
So we got to be real careful and really start to work collectively. But the beauty in this, you're back in New York and we're here in the West Coast. We need to come together in between all those other states, in between, and start to work collectively. And we'll be able to turn this thing around relatively quickly. But anyway, great show. Glad you're on the show.
Thank you. You're
a very knowledgeable brother. So keep up the good work. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Brother Leonard. And, you know, I just, you know, just touch real quick on the collectivity aspect of it. I know it's extremely important, but understand why it becomes complicated for us to do things collectively is because we are being fed and we are actually consuming information from various sources that are conflicting. So we're not in a situation to collectively believe the same thing, because ideally it is to confuse us. They want Facebook to tell us one thing. They want Instagram to tell us another. They want YouTube to tell us another. They want the news to tell us another. There are things that we got to be very mindful of, and we got to talk about. And again, I love the name of your show, Intentional Radio, is that you got to keep in mind that there is intention in everything that's happening, good, bad, or indifferent, but they're all intention.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so it's been a collective, it's been, you know, it's been a struggle for us as a people collectively for a very long time. But, you know, you can go all the way back to the Willie Lynch letter, and it basically lets you know what the whole objective was for us to fight against each other. Mm-hmm. And it's a mindset that we haven't been able to shake, because most of us don't talk about that.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's funny. Excuse me. It's funny that you mentioned that, because with me, I always have to find an answer.
Yes.
And the reason why the Willie Lynch was so important, you have to ask yourself, what is the reason? What made them say, we got to find something to separate them and keep them separated for years?
Because
and if you go back to the history, back when
we got together,
they said, if you ever seen these people together like they saw in Africa, see, what they saw was unity like never before.
And they
and
don't
so
want that.
They don't ever want to see that again.
No, they don't.
See, they know that. And that's why you were talking about the history. They'll tell you, Christopher Columbus, the Southerners, George Washington. And, you know, when we don't take the time to understand, George Washington, just say the last name, Washington. And then say Jackson. You don't know no white Washington. All the Washingtons you know are black.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You only know maybe two people that have last name Jackson that are white, and that's the basketball coach.
Coach Phil Jackson,
ago.
Yeah.
But most of the Jacksons you know
they're black.
Are black.
Same with Jefferson.
That don't make any sense.
Same with Jefferson.
And the Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to have that kind of conversation so they'll understand, well, why is that? But if we don't feed that to them, as you mentioned before with education, they'll never know.
Yes.
But anyway, I just wanted to touch on that part about Willie Lynch.
It's about what we feed, what we're feeding each other, right? And if, you know, again, it's biblical, you reap what you sow. And most instances, we sow distrust.
Yeah.
We sow contentment. We sow the individuality. We sow that. And so that's what we reap in return. So in all actuality, it is important for us to recognize that too has been a strategic and intentional plan for us to never to collectively come together and
absolutely.
Do things.
Absolutely. That's the plan.
How we change that is through the conversations like this and say, hey, wait a minute, let's be careful. Like, don't say that because that doesn't apply to everybody. Yeah. Because most people's comments that they make are not applicable to everybody. It's only applicable to a few people because that's what people want to hear.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, black on black crime.
Yeah.
Guess what? In them same projects where black on black crime is supposed to be an issue, there are people that bust their butt, go to work every single day, work.
But they don't want you to know about that.
Just to make ends meet.
Right.
Before we get out of here, before we get out of here, give people
a whole lot of time talking about all of the white folks that have committed all these massacres.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's strictly a white thing.
How do people get in touch with
you? We haven't talked about white folks going out there shooting everybody at the concert, going shooting everybody at the church, shooting everybody at the school, wherever they can go shoot, at the theater. We haven't talked about that, but they get on black crime. Yeah.
But how do people get in touch with you? Your social media, email, how do people get in touch with you, Dennis? Yes,
there's a couple of ways. You can get in touch with me at DennisMckesey@gmail, DennisMckesey@gmail.com. You can find me on Instagram at there's two Instagram posts over, two Instagram handles. The first is the official OSG, which is this, the official Off School Grounds on Instagram and on Facebook. And then also, too, same thing on LinkedIn. You can find me at Dennis McKesey as well. So.
Well, thank you. It's been great.
You are with us on Saturday. You're one of our panelists on Saturday.
I look forward to it.
This is going to be a great conversation. And the reason we're doing this, it's simply to get people to think and think about change. Stop doing what you've always done. You're going to always get what you've always got.
Yeah.
Change it.
Appreciate it, man. It was a great conversation.
This is an opportunity. Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Dennis. I'm glad you stayed with us the entire time.
I look forward to I will come anytime you invite me. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Take care, man.
Thank you so much.
Stay warm in New York, man.
Take care.
All right.
Thanks, Dennis. We'll talk later.
All right.